the week of October 30th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 124, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Wellington, New Zealand, I'm Michael Giltz.
Why are you in Wellington, New Zealand? I don't understand why you would be in
New Zealand. The Hobbit, part one, The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, is going to make its world premiere in Wellington, New Zealand in 2012. And I wanted to make sure I had a good seat.
Well, you're there more than a year early because I think it's premiering.
I'm in line. Yeah. Do you think that's too? I was worried I wasn't here enough. There were only 30 people in front of me. So I don't know what the, we don't know what the rules are going to be yet as far as ticket distribution, but we're hoping.
30 people are in front of you.
Okay. I'm not really in New Zealand.
Okay. Just checking.
But I am excited by The Hobbit.
Well, hopefully you're excited about today's show because on today's show, we will give you a rundown of how the new television season is shaping up. Which series are faring well and which didn't make the grade, i.e. got canceled. In the end, however, it turns out football seems to be getting all the ratings. We'll also discuss Google's plans for a new music store, as well as learn that streaming music service Pandora is taking on radio stations by scooping up all the local advertisers. We've already talked a little bit about the new technology called Ultraviolet, which will allow you to watch any DVD or, well, not any DVD, but certain DVDs and Blu-rays that you purchase on a number of mobile devices and computers. Now we'll go into a little bit more detail. Broadway plays are finding some success this fall, we'll explain. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop and end with some correspondence from listeners. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire and apparently a number 30 in the Wellington, Michael Giltz. He's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie around the world at the box office is The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn, which grossed $55.8 million worldwide. It opened overseas in about 19 very big markets. It is the number one movie. It's going to be open for about 2 months before it comes to America. And in the trailer for the U.S. version of this film, the trailer that's been released online, the English language version, he is referred to as Tintin.
I know.
Now, we know that in France and in much of the world, and perhaps in England even, they refer to him as Tonton. I don't know what they do in the UK. I shouldn't say that. But if there's any Brits out there, come let us know. But he's known as Tonton throughout much of the world that loves this character. He's not well known in the US. But here in our trailers and the audio for the film version here, they do call him Tintin, which is the way one might pronounce his name if you just glance at the word.
And I can tell you that the distributor in the US, Paramount, also calls him Tintin, and having seen the film, I can tell you that throughout the film, he's called Tintin.
So that's what they're doing for us English language schmucks who don't really love Tonton. So if you want to be cool, refer to him as Tonton. If you're talking about his box office overseas, which we're doing right now, we should say The Adventures of Tonton. 55.8 million. It's the number one movie around the world. It's a good example of why we like to look at the worldwide box office rather than just the U.S. The number two movie around the world is Puss in Boots, the Shrek spinoff. It grossed $51 million worldwide. It is, of course, the number one movie in the U.S., and it's off to a decent start.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say $51 million is pretty – well, I guess it didn't make $51 million in the U.S., but it made $34 million in the U.S., $51 million worldwide. They spent, what, $150 million or $130 million to produce it, figure another $70 million to promote it worldwide. So you're up to $200 million. They have to clear, what, $400 million before
Are we back to this?
No, I'm
Let's just say the Shrek, the DreamWorks films tend to do very well around the world. They have a strong, strong base, so they probably can look to – it's a very solid launch for this movie. Halloween is a slow weekend for films. It's sort of counter-programming in a way to release Puss in Boots on a Halloween weekend, but it worked. We'll have to see how it does for the rest of the year. They expect it to have legs, just like a lot of their other films, like How to Train a Dragon and other movies that were written off as, you know, disasters because they didn't have a massive opening, which this isn't compared to the Shrek films. But we'll see how it pans out in the end. But if you listen to us, you can rest assured it will have a very strong overseas market and it should do quite well overall.
I guess this is DreamWorks' worst opening since Flushed Away, which doesn't really mean much, but I guess.
Well, people yelled and screamed over How to Train a Dragon. That ended up making a very strong, solid amount worldwide. Puss in Boots has great reviews. It's a spinoff from another series. You shouldn't expect it to equal Shrek. And it's a very strong, solid launch.
I like the way that Anne Globe she's the worldwide head of marketing over at DreamWorks Animation. She was talking to the Hollywood Reporter, she was talking to the Los Angeles Times, and she said, when we moved the movie to Halloween weekend, we were looking at a two-weekend strategy. I thought that was very interesting that, you don't often hear studios talking that way where they are actually saying, look, we're going to get one or two weekends. Now, people who work in the industry know why certain films shift, because they know they will have a big opening weekend, a pretty decent second weekend, but then another movie will come in and take its place in the third weekend. So they're really just hoping to get a lot of money those first two weekends. But here it's, you know, being quoted in a pretty big newspaper.
That's not what she meant by that, was it?
Oh,
she didn't mean we'll make all our money in the first two weekends and then we're done.
Well, the two-weekend strategy, that's she's not done after the second.
Well, I think what she was referring to, perhaps I'm wrong, is that they'd had a sort of a pattern of releasing movies 1 week after Halloween. And that early November release date was one that they loved and that they were using. But in fact, this year they decided to push it back. Instead of having that early November release, they pushed it back to Halloween weekend because they felt like there was an opportunity to have a solid opening this weekend. And the next weekend they could hold or even grow and show some really good news. But I think their strategy is very much like their other films. It's long term. They got good reviews. It's families. They expect this movie to be in theaters until Christmas. And I think that they'll find out that that's going
to
work.
Well, she goes on to say, with strong support, we should play into November, given the strong word of mouth. So she, you know, that led me to believe the two-weekend strategy statement that she was making, and that's Anne Globe of DreamWorks Animation, that she...
Right. They thought if they opened it up next weekend, they would have a bigger opening, but they felt it was worthwhile to open 1 week earlier, as if there is such a thing as earlier for a movie that has never been released before. But earlier than they've typically done, people often avoid Halloween weekend. But they opened up 1 week early because they felt like those first two weekends would better position the movie overall than if they opened it up next week. Anyway, number one around the world, Tonton, $55 million. Number two around the world, Puss in Boots. Number three around the world, Paranormal Activity 3, which is hard to say suddenly because it's at number three, I guess. It grossed $35 million worldwide. It's at $124 million and counting. At number four is the Justin Timberlake film In Time, which grossed $26 million worldwide. At number five around the world is the Hugh Jackman film. He's just opened on Broadway. He's just starting previews on Broadway in his one-man show, which is a smash hit already. His film is called Real Steel. It's not such a smash hit. It grossed $17 million worldwide. It's at $182 million and counting. It's okay, but not great news for Universal. At number six is The Three Musketeers, $16.3 million worldwide. It's just about to pass $100 million worldwide and counting. At number seven is Johnny English Reborn, the Rowan Atkinson spoof of James Bond. It's grossed another $13.6 million worldwide. It's at $131 million and counting. That's another good example of why we like to look at worldwide box office. In the U.S., this movie had two weekends and it was gone. Worldwide, however, if you look at Johnny English Reborn, you can see this is a very successful franchise for Rowan Atkinson. At number eight is Rise of the Planet of the Apes. It opened in China. So it grossed another $7 million, and it's now at $452 million worldwide. At number nine is it was $9.2 million total. At number nine is Contagion at $8.4 million worldwide. The Matt Damon film is doing okay. It's at $110 million and counting. Number 10 is Footloose. It's a little tricky to find out how much it grossed overseas. We know it grossed $5.4 million in the U.S. It probably grossed a little bit more overseas, but I wasn't able to nail down that number. Its worldwide total is $46 million so far. And number 11 is The Rum Diary, the Johnny Depp film based on the Hunter S. Thompson novel. It opened basically in the U.S., but it grossed $5 million. It's his worst opener in many, many years.
Well, this is his like kind of passion project. He was friends with Hunter S. Thompson before Thompson committed suicide in 2005. But, you know, this is really for him. This is... I don't want to say it's a vanity project, but it's one that Depp holds close to his heart. And he went, you know, on tour to different colleges to promote the film. But you're right.
Yeah, he really got out and hustled to try and sell the film. He made himself available for interviews. They've held it on the shelf for quite a while to try and find a point in his schedule where he could sort of, you know, thump the drum for the movie. He definitely, you know, did his part to try and help launch the film.
Yeah. Yes, I would agree.
But it you know, it had poor reviews. It's been sitting on the shelf. People weren't excited about it, I'm afraid. Go rent Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. At number 12, 13, and 14, we have some films that are big hits in their local territories. At number 12 is A Monster in Paris, which grossed $4 million. It's a French animated comedy about a monster and a nightclub singer. At number 13 is another French film, Police, which we saw in Cannes. It grossed $3.5 million. It's a drama about cops who are on the child protection beat. It's grossed $8.8 million in France alone. And at number 14 is a Japanese hit called A Ghost of a Chance, which grossed $3 million. It's a comedy fantasy that opened at number one in the box office in Japan this weekend.
Last week we were off, so we didn't get a chance to talk about the really strong performance. I mean, strong. It was the you know, highest. It was record breaking. The record breaking opening of Paranormal Activity 3. And the record it broke is it's the strongest, highest opening for a horror film of all time.
Yeah, of all time. Yeah. No, it's a tremendous opener for movies that all three films total cost about $18 million to make, I think, is the total right now. And they cost pennies to make. It's the new Saw, a cheap series that they're going to put out every Halloween until people get sick of them. And the second one was so bad that in a way they've kind of revived the franchise a little bit with the third one. It's not getting great reviews or anything, but fans seem to be enjoying this one more. It's going to fall fast like any horror film, but you know, they're making them for a dime. They've got a strong franchise. We've had, you know, the adults in the first two, the kids are the focus in the third one. I don't know what they're going to do for the fourth one. Maybe it'll be the pets. Maybe the pets will start running around in the middle of the night.
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, that didn't work. All right.
I don't know. Well, no, I was just looking at...
I don't know what you do with that franchise, but, you know, the relatives, pets, I don't know. But they'll keep making them. There's no question about that. We got a little overseas news about The Help, which has been a massive success in the U.S. It's so far grossed a total of $16 million overseas. It's opened in about 16 territories. Not sure how many territories there are. I saw one film that said it had opened in 48 territories. That's probably close to the limit of how many worldwide territories there are. Is that about right, Sperling?
That's probably about right. I mean, certainly there are, what, like 197 to 225 countries in the world, but each country is not necessarily a territory. There's a big difference there because, you know, you can have a European territory and that might encompass, you know, 5, 6, 7 different countries.
Right, and when you're looking at grosses overseas and you see it's opened in 5 territories or 19 territories, well, like I think Tintin, I think it opened in about 19 territories, but they're very big territories.
Right.
So you can't just say, oh, it's opened in 19 and it has 30 to go, and therefore it will, you know, make 2.5 times what it already – it doesn't work that way. It's opened in England and Germany and Japan. You've made a lot of your money already. So you got to keep an eye on that. But The Help has opened in a number of territories, including Australia. It's grossed $60 million overseas. Not great. I guess they really couldn't hold on it until end of the year and Oscar hopefulness to try and sell it even more overseas. But, you know, it's making some money. It's probably close to going to make back what it costs to make. So overseas, that's pretty good.
Well, now, a couple things on that, just to kind of underscore what you just said. It cost $150 million to make.
No. The Help?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were still talking about Tintin.
No. Tintin, okay. Yes, I saw that number. They claim Tintin cost $150, $175 million to make. That sounds awfully low.
Well, after tax credits. It cost $175 million. So,
well, I'd like to know what it costs before tax credits, because that's...
Well, and they're spending another $100 million to market the thing. And this is what I found fascinating, that Spielberg and Jackson, Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson, will pull 30% of the gross out before they can start recouping. I mean, that's an astronomical figure.
Who reported that?
That was both in the LA Times and the Hollywood Reporter.
They're saying first dollar gross?
Well, I don't know. It says...
It says revenue. You have here written revenue.
Yes, correct. So
I'm not
sure
what that means.
Yeah, we don't know what that means. We can't read
but
into
30%
that
of anything after, whether it's after the movie grosses X number of dollars or whatever, that's a lot.
Right. And you would imagine that Spielberg has first dollar gross. I mean, he is still the one director that could probably get that.
Yeah. Well, I'm James Cameron too, I imagine.
Yes,
could.
That's true. Yes.
There's a few others, but yeah, no, he's the man. And Peter Jackson is the man too.
But I mean, what do you think of opening the film overseas first and then bringing it here 2 months later? I mean, for piracy, that's a big problem, but it is in 3D, so maybe that'll cut down on some of the piracy.
I think it's not a film that's in demand massively in the U.S. Anybody who wants to pirate a copy of Tintin in the U.S. is somebody who's probably going to pay again to see it in the theater.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's not a film. It's, if you're a nut that you want to watch this movie early now in advance, you probably are the sort of person who really wants to see it and will go see it in the theater. I don't mean piracy isn't a problem, but whatever. That doesn't concern me. It's a bigger property overseas. Let it play in the rest of the world. Let it come to the U.S. as a world champion, world-beating, massively grossing hit film, and you have a better chance of setting it up, I think, than you would if you opened it up worldwide at the same time. Plus, of course, they felt the slot was better in the U.S. when they're opening it. And overseas, there are a lot of kids' vacations in the next 2 months.
That's right.
England, France, Germany, they've got... every weekend, some kid has a holiday. So they've got a lot of opportunities to make a lot of money from families on vacation or, you know, kids out of school over the next 2 months. So that's going to help the box office a lot. It's definitely going to have legs.
I don't think it will get good word of mouth among parents in the United States. Having seen it, I can tell you that, you know, much like the comic books, there's nothing going on in the movie. It's one adventure after
another. Have
we
spoken since you'd seen it?
I don't think so, no.
No, I didn't know you'd seen it. Yeah. How was it?
It was, you know.
You're probably not allowed to review it. Well, I don't know. It's been reviewed already.
Yes, it's been reviewed already. And the 3D is phenomenal.
Really? Because now, you know, not a big fan of 3D. Is it something where you go, wow, this is really, really worthwhile to see in 3D?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Steven Spielberg, not only moving into digital filmmaking, something he's not a big fan of, but also into 3D, something else he hasn't really talked about too much, but you can kind of sense that he's not a big fan of. He said, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it right. And he does. He does it right.
Is it just fun, or is it just like things come out at you all the time? Or what way does it work as 3D? Do you feel like it's a world that you're in? Or
yes, it definitely feels like a world. And, you know, he's constantly moving the camera. That's, you know, a Spielberg characteristic for all of his films.
He's not Ozu.
No, he's not Ozu. That's for sure. Where, you know, you're basically locked onto a tripod for 2.5 hours. But it's, you know, that's something you really don't want to do with a 3D film. You don't want to move the camera as much.
It's a lot harder.
Yes. And he does a very good job of it. And he creates these interesting spaces where 3D really works. And
But you think the movie's really for kiddies?
It really is. I mean, the animation is much better than any of the Zemeckis projects that use that kind of mocap animation. But the story is just, there is no story. It's just... I mean, there is, but it's not all that interesting. It's not like Raiders of the Lost Ark, where you were really engaged into what's going to happen. It was just kind of this happens, then that happens, then this other thing happens.
Well, it's sacrilege, but for us, Tintin is sort of a boring character.
Right, exactly. And much like the comic book, the same thing. I mean, the characters, some of the characters are really great, like Thompson and Thompson, and, you know, the dog.
What about Andy Serkis as the drunken sailor captain or whatever?
Oh, he's good, actually. He's very good.
Is it a commercial hit?
Oh, it's a commercial hit. Absolutely. Absolutely.
But it's for kids.
It's for kids. Yes.
So you'll take, did your kids like it?
They have not seen it yet.
Okay. Will you go back again?
I will have to go back again. So the answer to that is yes.
There you go.
Whether I want it or not.
And a lot of people took their kids to The Lion King. Worldwide gross is now at about $159 million. It grossed $109 million in the U.S. and another $50 million overseas. So they weren't able to capitalize as much on that reissue around the world as they were in the U.S., which is sort of interesting to me.
Well, that's The Lion King 3D, so we should say it's not the original Lion King. It's kind of an addition.
The Lion
to
King, displayed in 3D, yes.
Well, you know what I'm waiting for is 3D will eventually move into the home. And when it does, I think sports will be the first to go.
Ugh.
You know, you're
I'm not convinced at all. No? I do not want to – if I love sports. I watch sports all the time. I can see how fun it would be to glance at – baseball or football or basketball or bull riding with glasses. Those events last 3 hours, 4 hours. People spend all day Sunday watching football. I can't imagine guys sitting around for 10 hours wearing 3D glasses while they watch the football games. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I've said it before, though.
Right, and I'm kind of with you on that. I don't see people sitting in a bar with glasses on, which
they clearly won't do it in a bar.
Right, and if you're...
You couldn't have 200... you couldn't have 200 glasses available for them to look at it.
Right. And I've seen, pictures of people in bars, you know, with their 3D glasses on, but those were special occasions and special events that were staged specifically to get those photos. So.
Yeah, obviously. No bar does that as a matter of course.
Right.
But people love sports.
That's right. They do. Now, do you spend all day Sunday watching, any of the football games?
I tape everything, you know. I have very little, even the World Series, some of it I watched on tape delay because I can't stand commercials anymore. It drives me nuts. But I'm not a football person, so I don't watch football. But everybody else does.
Apparently so.
Yes. I mean, it's football has been the saving grace for NBC. It's the only good news they have. It's the only show they have in the top 20. And the pregame show is also in the top 30. I mean, they're in a disastrous free fall, but they do have Sunday Night Football, which they paid a ton of money for. But football isn't just helping NBC. It's helping everybody. It helps NBC, CBS, Fox, ESPN. All of them are benefiting from football. It's amazing. You look at the season so far, the NFL games have accounted for 13 of the 15 most watched fall TV programs.
What about the World Series? That sixth game of the World Series, I think, will go down as a classic in baseball history.
Oh, it was a great, great game. The whole series was terrific. But yeah, game six was insane. It just went back and forth, back and forth. If only it had been in 3D. And that reached 23 million viewers, which is a ton.
Yes, that is.
But football, you know, that was a ton for a World. That was the highest rated World Series game of this year. Thursday night kickoff game between the Saints and the Packers reached 27 million viewers.
So that just kind of goes
a regular
to show
season
you.
Game yeah. on football reached 27 million viewers. I mean, that's a lot, but they're averaging 22 million viewers on Sunday night football for NBC.
That's huge. That is a huge figure.
Yeah. So, you know, football is where it's at. It's on number of network schedules. And the great news for the NFL is that about three of them are going to be coming up for renewal in 2013. And so everybody's going to have to fork over a gazillion dollars. ESPN just spent a ton of money on football, as we reported. And now everybody is going to want to re-up. Everybody's going to want to try and steal games from their competitors. Football is in the driver's seat.
Well, now going from football, which is getting 27 million viewers or 22 million viewers on a regular basis, to the X Factor, which Simon Cowell hoped, and who is the producer and creator of the X Factor, hoped that they would be getting 20 million viewers, but they're not.
Yes, he now says he was stupid and wrong to have boasted that if the show didn't hit at least 20 million viewers, it would be a flop. He now says that's not true. We're doing great.
Well, he has to, because what else are you going to say when you're only pulling in 10 million viewers?
Right. The short answer is that Fox overprojected for the show, as did I, that Fox overpromised to advertisers and that they're now having to do make goods and lower the price of their ads and, you know, give free ad space to advertisers.
Okay, yeah, wait a second. I'd like to say, you know, for those of you who don't know what a make good is, Michael, why don't you explain what a make good is?
Well, when you buy an ad for a show, they guarantee a certain base level of rating. They say, you know, well, we're going to reach 8 million people.
Right.
And they expect to reach 10 or 12, and then the advertiser's thrilled. You know, and they feel like, oh, I made a bargain. I bought an ad at a rate where I was expecting to reach 8 million people, and the show turned into a hit, and it reached 12 or 14, and I've, you know, graded bonus money by picking a hit early. The network, of course, wants to make it as high as possible without overpromising. When they overpromise, like they did on the X Factor, then they do a make good. They said, you know what? You bought an ad expecting to reach 18 million people or 17 or 15, whatever they might have promised, even though they hope to reach 20. And they said, we're going to sell you this ad. We're guaranteeing you're going to reach 15 million people. You ended up reaching 12 million people. We fell 3 million people short. So we're going to make it up for you by giving you an extra 30-second ad in episode 10.
Right. So basically, you know, when an advertiser comes in, they buy on what's called a cost per thousand. So, you know, they'll pay $20 or $30 CPM. And of course, when you're talking millions, that's, you know, a fortune. But when you've actually paid for something, so they've paid for 15 million. So Fox really has to give them that inventory. They have to say, well, we only gave you 12 million. So you ordered a burger with fries. We gave you the burger and no fries. So they have to effectively cough up some, you know, the extra 3 million impressions that they're supposed to be serving.
So the Wall Street Journal says the X Factor is doing poorly because they're having to do all these make goods. It's true. The American Idol last season reached an average of 25 million people. So far, roughly, X Factor is reaching about 12 million people.
Right.
So there's about half the number. The good news is that it's a hit. It's doing well. It's in the top 10 or top 20. It's in the top 10 every week, actually, I think, pretty much. Fox used to be asleep in the fall. Fox literally had no television for years and years until you hit the spring and you had American Idol and 24 and one or two other shows. They literally slept during the fall season, did nothing until they got to the spring and had American Idol. Now suddenly they're competing in the fall with this and some other stuff. So they have woken up a network that literally didn't program for half the year. So it's a big investment, costs a lot of money, but they're in new territory for Fox.
Well, and it's kind of amazing to me that you can actually have between 10 and 12 million viewers and still be considered iffy or, you know, a so-so success.
Right. Well, it's in the top 10, you know.
Right.
It's in the top 10, so it's definitely a hit. It's doing well. It's winning its time slot. It's a successful show. It's reaching young people. I have to say, I felt like it's really kicked into high gear, you know.
You're watching it still?
Oh, I watch the show, and their production, whenever I watch The X Factor in the UK, I was stunned at how much flashier and bigger the show was. It just was produced as an extravaganza, made the American Idol look shabby in comparison. And frankly, and Idol stepped up its game year after year trying to catch up. But I would say The X Factor here really, with its first live shows, has stepped up its game again. It looks like what Idol looks like during their season finale. You know, it just feels like a big, big show with flashy production values. It feels like a full performance concert rather than just someone going on stage and singing to a backing track.
Right.
And I feel like they've got a top 12. They've got three or four people who are actually interesting. You know, they've got already a far more interesting batch of singers than Idol had all of last season.
Well, according to some of the stuff I've read over the past week, that now that X Factor is, I guess they're broadcasting live.
Yeah, it's just starting, yeah.
Yeah, that portion of the series is just starting, and their ratings are going up because of it.
Well, yeah, that's what happens with American Idol as well. We had the auditions, and then the judges making their choice of who to put in their team, and now we have the live performances, and they were sort of punted around by baseball. Rescheduled, didn't happen, moved to a different night. That's all been very confusing. So they're really going to just start proving themselves next week. They've got 12 performers who I think some of them are really, really talented and interesting. And they've had some good drama. And you know what? Chances are that by the end of the season, you know, I was wrong about how big they would be when they open. But given the talent that they have on the show and the wide range of appeal from a little kid who's a rapper to middle-aged people in their 40s and 50s who are, you know, getting their last chance at stardom to more traditional young divas and an R&B group that's sort of like Boys to Men. The whole range is so much more interesting. And I think vocally that they're a lot better performers than you've seen on Idol. I bet that this show grows a little bit and gains a little, it's inevitable it should gain steam as they approach the finale, unless the show's a big flop. They've got the people, they've got the talent. I think they're going to start putting together really good live shows and people are going to start turning in a little bit. And it's going to end up at the end of the season being more popular than it was at the beginning. And it'll probably set itself up quite well for next year. What really matters is the people you put on stage. And they've done a good job. Simon Cowell's done it again on that level.
Well, you know, what shows aren't gaining any viewers are some of the shows that have been canceled this year.
That's right.
Pan Am was canceled? I didn't know that.
No, Pan Am will be canceled any day now. It keeps dropping. It's inevitable that it be canceled.
Okay, so this is the series with Christina Ricci that takes place in the 60s. It's kind of a Mad Men ripoff in that regard. The Playboy Club, which was another Mad Men ripoff, was already canceled by NBC, so that would mean ripping off Mad Men is a lot harder than it looks. Charlie's Angels, a rehash of the 70s show, was canceled by ABC. Of course, we've already talked about Free Agents over on NBC being canceled. That was starred Hank Azaria. Hater, which was on the CW, was pulled from the schedule. And How to Be a Gentleman was moved to Saturday, and then, of course, the production was ceased, meaning that we could always bring it back, but they're not going to.
Yeah, that's a CBS show. Everybody is mostly being patient. You know, they don't have a choice these days. You tend not to pull shows really quickly. NBC showed a lot of patience by waiting 2 or 3 weeks to cancel the Playboy Club. It's not as many shows that'll be gone. Not all the shows that have been picked up for the full season will be back next year. But there's good news. The Walking Dead on AMC had a massive opening Sunday.
That was a record-breaking opening for cable, wasn't it?
Yeah, the numbers came out about an hour or two after we finished recording. I was kind of bummed. I thought it was a strong season beginning. Frank Darabont is no longer with the show, of course, so that's very interesting. They got off to a very solid start, and they, of course, already renewed it for season 3.
Right, and Frank Darabont was the showrunner and, of course, the director of movies like The Green Mile, and he's no longer with it, as you mentioned, so it'll be interesting to see how they continue through this season.
Yeah, and other shows that have already been picked up. Person of Interest, Unforgettable, and Two Broke Girls on the CBS. CW has picked up almost everything they had. Ringer, The Secret Circle, and Heart of Dixie.
But did they have any choice? I don't think so.
They don't, though. The one thing I will say, looking at the ratings week to week, Ringer, The Secret Circle, which is sort of a Charmed, and Heart of Dixie, which has the girl from The OC. None of these shows are doing great. CW has only one show that's reaching more than 2 million viewers a week, and that is The Vampire Diaries. The one thing I will say, though, is that these new shows have such tepid week lead-ins, but all three of them, I believe, are improving on their lead-ins. The Secret Circle especially, not Secret Circle because that follows Vampire Diaries, but the others on the CW I look at, and they are, in fact, finding, you know, reaching an audience. They're bringing in a couple extra 100,000 people, which is notable. You know, you got to give them kudos for that. They have very poor lead-ins from old, tired shows, and they're actually bringing in some viewers. They're not hits. You know, less than 2 million viewers can't be described as a hit. But they are showing signs of life in the sense that people are finding and tuning into Heart of Dixie who aren't watching the show that, you know, airs before it.
Now, over on ABC, Revenge, Suburgatory, and Happy Endings. Oh, I guess Happy Endings was picked up, but only for 6 scripts. So they've picked up 3 shows.
Right, and they're still doing very poorly. I don't think they're going to make it to the end of the season. If they do, they probably won't be back another year.
And on NBC, 2 shows that I watch, Up All Night, which stars Christina Applegate and Will... Is it Will, who is that? The guy from Arrested Development.
Will Arnett.
Will Arnett, yes, thank you. You know, I love that show. It was picked up. Whitney was picked up as well. And on Fox, New Girl was picked up, but that was picked up ages ago, and we've already talked about that.
Right. So New Girl is on. The X Factor is there for the whole season. The question is Terra Nova, whether they need to commit soon to a new season. So they'll have to decide whether they feel like Terra Nova has signs of life and is worth the money.
I think they will commit to a new season.
I think they will, too. I think it's done decently enough.
I think, you know, Peter Chernin, the former head of Fox, is the producer of that show. And so I think they're going to do that. They might only give it one more season, but I think they're going to commit to one more season because it's getting enough viewers. It's in the between 8 and 12 million viewer range. So it's not.
And again, Fox has had zero hits in the fall for about a decade now. That's
right.
Not really an exaggeration. Not counting the Animation Sunday, where Family Guy and other stuff churns along. But as far as their live-action shows, they have not been alive in the fall whatsoever for years.
Well, somebody who has been alive for years, at least on television, in terms of being on hit television shows, is Charlie Sheen, and it looks like he's going back to TV. But like Conan O'Brien, he's moving over to basic cable. He's going to be on FX.
Yeah, we reported about this show before. Now it's just found a network, which is going to FX. It's going to be similar to the way shows like Tyler Perry's House of Pain were launched. They're going to film 10 episodes. They're going to air them. And if they reach certain ratings level, which they will, because there's going to be a huge interest in them, then the show will get picked up for an additional 90 episodes. So they make them all one at a time, quick, cheap, just do a whole, you know, run of a show really quick. And then they will spiel them out over, you know, the next 2 years. And everybody would be happy.
Yeah, and the show in question, we'd never actually named it, is Anger Management, which is based on the 2003 film starring Jack Nicholson and Adam Sandler.
Right, so, and it's got a good showrunner, Bruce Helford, who was one of the creators on the Drew Carey Show and the George Lopez Show.
He wrote on Roseanne, he wrote on Family Ties. He's a very experienced showrunner.
That's right. So it's, you know, there's going to be a lot of interest in it. It's sure to have big ratings when it opens. He's sure to bring people to it. And it's another example of Charlie Sheen in turnaround, just like his casting in a film by Roman Coppola. Roman Coppola's not a huge director, but it's a lead role in a film called A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan III. It co-stars Bill Murray, Jason Schwartzman, and Mary Elizabeth Winstead. It would have been very, very hard, I think, to win a lawsuit against Charlie Sheen and say he was incapable of working as he lands a sitcom and a feature film and all that.
I was a little surprised at how many people, at least on Twitter, were shocked that Charlie Sheen's sitcom would land anywhere, but that if, you know, FX picked it up. I don't understand why everybody was so surprised. Why wouldn't they pick it up? Because they're only doing 10 episodes, and if it's a failure, they've only done 10 episodes. It's not a big deal.
I think it was the idea of whether it was a good fit for FX. You know, Two and a Half Men was such a broad traditional comedy that Charlie Sheen doesn't seem like an edgy person anymore, and you know, when you're talking about a network that has Wilfred and other offbeat strange shows like that, whether Charlie Sheen's Anger Management fits in with the vibe there. They could have seen TBS picking it up, and that wouldn't have made anybody blink an eye. But FX picking it up is a little more questionable. However, FX has picked up reruns of Two and a Half Men.
Right, so they probably needed some fresher.
Well, they're
Charlie
in the Charlie
Sheen
business, baby. They love Charlie Sheen, and they, you know, if they believe in Two and a Half Men as bringing in an audience, why not have a new show with Charlie Sheen?
You know, I liked what the Time columnist James, I'm going to get his name wrong here, but he's the TV columnist over there at Time Magazine, James Poniewozik.
I don't know.
He wrote on Twitter, FX picks up Charlie Sheen sitcom. Deal could total 100 episodes. I'd advise taping them all in like a week just to be safe.
What
can you say? I mean, that's pretty much the punchline right there. There's not much needs to be said after that.
But I think in music, however, this story is a little oversold that we're about to get to.
Right. And our last episode, we talked about how Amazon is moving into publishing and they're going to publish 122 titles this fall without going through traditional publishers. They themselves will be the publisher. And now Billboard magazine is asking, you know, is Amazon, which is becoming a book publisher, is music next? And they kind of hedge a little bit and they say, well, we don't think they would do as well in music.
Well, I don't know if they hedge. It's sort of a think piece. I mean, they're not doing anything that makes anybody say they're going into music.
No.
So,
no,
I mean, it's just
true.
A sheer fantasy piece, isn't it?
I think so. I think you're absolutely right. I think you're right. I mean, they kind of talk about how iTunes has 33% of the U.S. recorded music business and Walmart has 10.1%. Whereas in the books, Amazon has like 50% of all books sold go through Amazon. And they're saying there's no way that Amazon could get to the 50% mark in music.
Well, that's that's neither here nor there. I mean, the idea is that you would want to go into music because you can make more money off of it. You don't need 50% of the market in order to make money. They want to compete with iTunes and Walmart. And so if they thought signing acts would help them increase market share, and if they just thought they could make money off of it, regardless of whether the market share increased, why not?
Right. And they say here, in the near term, it's more likely that Amazon will release exclusives, but leave the business of being a record label to others. And they kind of talk about how, you know, independent artists or big artists could have dumped their labels years ago and gone indie and done it themselves.
And
they never
have.
Yeah, a few have, but, you know, like Radiohead, but and a few haven't. And then Pearl Jam, you know, did a special deal with Target. And there are certain acts that do deals with specific stores like Best Buy or Walmart. And so they're saying
The Eagles have an album out through Walmart, sort of thing. I hate all those exclusives.
Ugh, they're horrible. I agree with you. But, you know, they're trying to, you know, Amazon, you're right. They need to compete with some of these brick and mortar stores, much the way Pandora is competing with local radio stations.
Ooh, what's going on there? Well, I mean, we know Pandora already attracts a lot of listeners. We know that they're very popular all over the country. We know they have national advertisers on their stations. How are they competing with local radio stations?
Well, they have 37 million active listeners here in the United States. I don't think they are available abroad. I don't think they have any licenses to play music overseas. So, you know, what Tim Westergren, the head of the company, said is, we are large enough as a company with our reach to be attractive to a huge palette of advertisers. Now we are large enough in smaller markets to attract the interest of local advertisers. That is traditionally the large source of revenue for broadcast radio. And the reason I read that quote is because he said it better than anybody else. He's absolutely right. If these guys come in and start stealing local advertisers, then local radio stations will kind of feel the pain.
Feel the pain is an understatement. Newspapers made a lot of their money, most of their money, off classified ads.
That's right.
And when classified ads disappeared, I mean, newspapers have never recovered from that loss of revenue.
No, thank you, Craigslist.
It's gone to Craigslist.
Right.
It's gone to online. When I rented my apartment, I took out a free ad in Village Voice and a free ad on Craigslist, and that was it. I got people in my home. They ripped me off, but that's a different story. But but if radio stations lose 10, 20% of their local advertising market,
That's huge.
That's a death knell.
Right. You know what isn't huge is that Pandora, which is a streaming music service where you can kind of create your own radio stations and you can say, well, I like John Coltrane. Play me John Coltrane music and music that's like John Coltrane. And you can create.
How about Miles Davis?
Right, exactly. they only have a catalog of 900,000 songs. I thought, you know, when you've got these.
Lord almighty, is that it?
Exactly. You have Spotify.
I've got 100,000 songs on my hard drive.
Yeah, and you have Spotify, Mog, Audio, you have all these other subscription services that have millions of tracks that you can listen to. Now, you don't own them. You can only listen to them. But still, you can stream millions of tracks. They have 900,000 songs. And they say about 95% of those songs get played in a given month.
Well, he's comparing that, of course, to what radio plays. And a broadcast radio station would play probably about 4 songs in a given month.
That's true. No, they'd play 6. Everybody knows
that. Yeah. So that's what he's comparing there. He's saying, look, we don't play, you know, Stairway to Heaven over and over and over again. We play a much broader range of our songs. We go deep in our catalog.
Right. And I guess what they're all after here is they're after 80% of the 16 hours of listening of music.
This was very confusing.
Well,
people listen to 16 hours of music a week.
Right. On the radio.
No. People listen to 16 hours of music a week. 80% of that is on broadcast radio.
Right, and 20% is music
that
you purchase.
They could also listen to CDs and stuff or whatever.
Well, the CDs is 20%. 20% of listening time each week is dedicated to music that people buy.
No. 16 hours. People listen to music 16 hours a week. 80% of that is on the radio. 20% of that is on CDs and other ways.
Boy, this was confusing. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, so they're trying to chip into that 80, you know, into that massive amount of time people listen to the radio, which they do in their car, driving to work, sitting in the backyard, whatever it may be.
And then Pandora is kind of moving into those things, you know, their
and I'd love to know what their percentage of their income for radio stations is from local advertisers. I bet it's 30, 40, 50% easily,
if not more.
Yeah, I mean, radio station in New York, I bet a big chunk of those advertising is from local advertisers, local restaurants. Local, you know, whatever.
Right.
And if they start to take a chunk out of that, they're in big trouble.
Well, somebody else trying to take a chunk out of Pandora is Google. They are going to be launching Google Music, which they kind of have Google Music already. And they launched it back in May. And it's just a digital locker where you can upload all of the music that you you own, and then you can stream it to connected devices, be it a computer or your phone, mostly Android devices rather than iPhone devices, since there is no iPhone app for Google Music. But now they're going to launch a store, much like iTunes is a store for the iPod and for Apple. Google is saying, well, we will launch a store and it will be, you know, our version of iTunes.
Do we haven't been able to see it yet, have we?
No. I mean, at this point, it's all talk. And then
does it launch?
Well, they're saying sometime before the end of the year. 2 weeks ago, Google's head of mobile, Andy Rubin, said that the company's long-awaited music store will actually be released with some kind of a quote-unquote twist. And now it's being rumored or talked about that that twist is that people who purchase songs through Google Music will be able to share them with friends. Now, this has been done for quite some time. In fact, I believe we call this BitTorrent.
Yeah.
Right. So that was a joke. You can laugh later if you'd like.
I just got it, actually. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, my jokes are very cerebral. You have to think about them for about 5 minutes before you laugh. You know, look, it's great that you can share music. And as Spotify is proving through its Facebook tie-in that, you know, people like to share music, Google Music will have a store. It will be straight download purchases. There will be no subscriptions. So it's the same thing as iTunes. I don't know. I mean, it's going to be hard to make people switch from the services they're already using. And as Amazon proved, the way to do that is through pricing.
So you think Google is going to try and have really cheap prices?
Well, I think, they might take it as a loss leader for a little while to get people used to using Google Music, used to purchasing on Google Music, and then slowly raise their prices.
What would be a loss leader for? They're not trying to sell a device. They're not trying to do anything except sell music.
Well, but they're trying to get you to use the Android operating system on handsets, on mobile devices, and on tablets. And why? Because
when people already are, of course.
Exactly. And so, you know, they're just trying to give you one more thing to tie you into the Google universe.
And being able to share a song is not a killer app.
No, not at all.
Give it to a friend and they can listen to it twice and then it disappears, or they can listen to it for 48 hours and then it disappears, whatever the terms might be. It's right. Nice, but whatever.
Right, exactly. I mean, you can listen to it twice before you can no longer listen to it again until you buy it. I mean, it's a nice little marketing tool. That's nice, but yeah. I don't think it's anything, you know, groundbreaking.
No.
But now, is the fact that plays on Broadway, not musicals, but plays, are doing better during the fall, is that groundbreaking? Is that something new?
Well, I don't quite agree with the New York Times analysis, but why don't you tell them what they said?
Well, the New York Times is talking about how last week, the average gross for straight plays on Broadway was higher than comparable data from recent seasons. So I guess last week, plays earned $540,477 on average, compared to $362,000 for the same week in 2010, and $439,000 for the comparable week in 2009. So they're saying, hey, look, plays, the average take for a play is up.
And then they also say that usually Broadway has maybe two hit plays at a time. Last year, it was The Merchant of Venice with Al Pacino and Driving Miss Daisy with Vanessa Redgrave and James Earl Jones. This year, we've got four plays in the fall that are hits. Of course, one of them opened in the spring. That was War Horse. That's the monster here. It is a straight play, technically. It's really, though, a spectacle, and it's practically a musical, and there's a lot of musical numbers in it, performances of music from people on the sides. There's a full score throughout the show, almost like a movie, and it's got puppetry. It's really a spectacle.
Well, when you think about it, I mean, plays are people talking, right? And the horse can't talk, so they have to have some kind of music, right?
No, I mean, it is a play.
Okay.
But it's just not, like you say, it's not two people talking. It's closer in spirit to the spectacle of a musical than a straight play.
Okay.
The other big show is The Mountaintop, starring Vanessa Redgrave, starring Samuel L. Jackson and Angela Bassett. That's going to be a short-run show. When they
16
leave.
16 weeks,
know,
yeah.
When they leave, they're gone.
Yeah.
Then there's Relatively Speaking, which is the 3 one-act plays with plays written by Woody Allen, Elaine May, and Ethan Coen. That's doing well. That has people like Marlo Thomas and Steve Guttenberg in it. And then there's Other Desert Cities, which is a transfer from Lincoln Center. It has a very starry Broadway cast, including Stocker Channing, Stacey Keach, and Rachel Griffiths from 6 Feet Under. And that's doing very well, too. It's good news.
I was interested in actually seeing some of the figures behind some of these shows. Last week, The Mountaintop, the Samuel L. Jackson star, it earned $789,000. That's, you know, finally we're kind of getting those figures. And I'm sure for insiders and for people in the know, those kinds of figures have been around for a while. But for those of us living on the other coast, i.e. the West Coast, Los Angeles, we don't normally get those kinds of figures.
Right. Well, if you look at the top shows, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Apparently,
10,
Michael knows how to count. Where
the top 10 shows, there's one play, which is War Horse, which is practically isn't a play in the sense of what a spectacle it is.
Right.
Then you go through the top 15. So you're looking at 9 out of the top 10 shows are musicals. 13 out of the top 15 are musicals. Musicals dominate. You've got Relatively Speaking in the Mountaintop in the top 15, and then you have to, then you know at the bottom you've got Seminar, which is an Alan Rickman play. Venus and Fur, Man and Boy, Chinglish are four of the top bottom five shows. You know, I mean, plays are not suddenly dominating Broadway. We've got a couple hits, which is great. One of them's going to be gone in a few weeks, but War Horse is a long-term smash hit. It's been a long time since we've had a play run that long. It's going to run for years. That's great, great news. Relatively Speaking, the Woody Allen thing, I'm not sure. I saw it. It was awful. The audience didn't even stand up and applaud. And today,
did they stand up and walk out?
On everything. As a matter of course, they couldn't be bothered. That's how weak this show is. So
yeah, I saw a kind of a revival of Annie by a regional theater group, you know, San Fernando Valley Regional Theater Group out in Thousand Oaks. And it was just so long and not necessarily great. It was, the pacing was off, the, you know, it was regional theater. And everybody stood up and applauded at the end, and I thought, I hope you're just standing up to leave, because I don't know why you'd be standing up to applaud that performance. But
people think it's part of a show to stand. So when they don't, I mean, not one person stood up. I mean, I was like, wow. I mean, I was just like, you know, trying to be polite, get the people off the stage so then we can leave. What I like to look at is, you know, average gross and this and that. It's hard to know. What I like to look at as far as how cheap are the tickets, how much are they discounting them, and how far below are they the potential gross. That's sort of the best measure, I think, of how well a show's doing.
And the potential gross is every seat in the house is sold for every performance.
Right, at regular price.
Right, exactly.
So when you're looking at shows that are 50% or below of potential gross, those are shows that are in trouble. They're in previews or they're not doing well at all. And you've got three of those are plays.
Yeah,
Venus and Fur, okay, which is in previews, and Man and Boy, which is a play starring
a boy and a man.
A boy and a man. Great stage actor Frank Langella. Bad show that's open to poor reviews, and Chinglish, which also opened to poor reviews. So all those three are in trouble. The only other two shows below 50% are Sister Act, the musical, and Godspell, which is also in previews. Now Venus and Fur and Godspell could come to life once they are reviewed, no question about it. And, you know, they're being heavily discounted because they want to get people in and get the word out. That's what you have previews for.
Well, we probably should have moved this next story up above theater or before theater, because it plays off of kind of what we were talking about with Google Music. And that is this information about Ultraviolet. Why don't you explain what Ultraviolet is, Michael?
Well, it seems like Ultraviolet is a positive thing where they're trying to make it as easy as possible for you to watch a movie that you've bought. I like these combo packs where you buy a movie like Alice in Wonderland or Avatar or whatever it is, and they give you a DVD, a Blu-ray, and a digital copy. I think that's smart.
It'd be nice if they didn't charge you $30 for that pleasure.
They shouldn't charge you a ton more. They're going to charge you a little more, but I think it's a positive when it's on sale. You'll find them usually within $5 to $10 of just even a DVD, or, you know, it's not that much more money. The less expensive it is, the better, but it's a good thing to try and make movies as flexible as possible for. You shouldn't have to decide where you want to watch a movie. You know, you want a Blu-ray for your Blu-ray player, a DVD for the car or the boat or whatever, and a digital copy for your laptop or your phone or your iPad.
And that's exactly what Ultraviolet is all about. It's a consortium of about 75 different companies, including, I guess, the Intels and the, you know, all the tech companies, and a whole bunch of content providers like studios. And it's a way to watch these, you know, they're like virtual lockers, but they're not really storing your version of the content. It's kind of a unified version of the content that you can then stream to your computer or right, to your mobile phone.
It's like a more flexible digital copy. They do allow you to download a digital copy onto a physical digital copy onto your computer or laptop or whatever it might be. You can do that. I've been trying to figure out if there's any different restrictions on that than there already are for your digital copies you get other ways. I haven't figured that out yet. It looks like you can download a digital copy just like other people offer for movies in the past, which is good. But they also offer the possibility of streaming the movie onto any one of your digital devices via this digital locker in the cloud. So the idea is, if for some bizarre reason you don't want to download your movie, maybe you think it takes up too much space or whatever. You've watched the movies you have on your iPad and you're somewhere where you have an internet connection and you want to watch a movie, you can go to your digital locker and stream it.
Yes, except you have to have, it's a major pain in the neck to set up. As I know you kind of mentioned before we started recording today that you tried to set it up. The Wall Street Journal has said the drawback is this tedious process in which you have to find this 12-digit code from the disk and then create an ultraviolet account. And then you have to have a Flixster account as well. And it's just really complicated to set up, not to mention the fact that not all the studios are on it. So Disney has their own little cloud service that they're trying to create called KeyChest. And you know what? You need everybody in one place or it's just not going to work.
Right. It is a pain in the neck to set up. I assume that would get better. What I don't understand is why you would go to the bother if you could have your digital copy.
I guess
the idea is you don't want to have to make sure your digital copy is on your iPad or your laptop or whatever, or storage of the copy is hard because it's such a big file and they want to give you this. It's like, well, all right, but I can – most of the time I'm going to want to watch a movie when I'm on a plane or in a car or somewhere where I don't probably have access to an internet connection. And so I would want the digital file anyway.
Right.
So I have to be somewhere where I can stream it. And then you have the issue of all that broadband usage that you're going to be doing. So if you have a cap.
Yes, that's true. And you know what they're also – they're trying to keep this whole idea of purchasing content alive. When in reality, what they could do is just sell you a subscription and say, hey, don't buy any of the DVDs. If you're going to stream them via Ultraviolet, just have a never-ending library available to you.
Not that they've offered this yet.
They have not offered this yet. No, but they're trying to get you to, you know, pony up the $20, $30 for a DVD or Blu-ray rather than, you know, have you rent these things.
I think what Ultraviolet is a solution in search of a problem.
Possibly.
If they're going to give you a digital copy, you don't need to stream it.
Right.
You don't need it in the cloud. If you want to store all your stuff in the cloud from your home, you might do that, but you don't need a separate storage system set up for your movies.
No. I mean, so then you don't think it's a big deal at all.
One more thing. I do wonder if you have thought a lot about, as people try and get us to move to the cloud, Amazon, Apple, everybody wants us to move to the cloud and have all our stuff stored in the cloud. And at the same time, all our internet providers are wanting to put caps on our broadband usage. This seems like two titanic forces ready to collide.
Oh, they most certainly will. Just you wait. I mean, that's not the big thing now, but it will be. Give it another 2 years, and this will be the big thing that everybody's talking about.
And that will be a big deal.
Yes, absolutely. Now, speaking of big deals, we should probably move along to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story, Doris Day gets honored. Doris Day is getting her due, finally. The movie star, pop star, TV star, friend to animals, and all-around cheery gal is getting a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Los Angeles Film Critics. Throughout the early 60s, she was the biggest movie star in Hollywood and was Oscar-nominated for her turn in the light comedy Pillow Talk with Rock Hudson. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal and a big whoop. I'm so gay. This is how gay I am. I got an email text from the Hollywood Reporter saying, Doris Day being honored. I was like, finally. You know, it said something like Lifetime Achievement. I said, finally, the Oscars are giving her due. People have been saying for years that she's, you know, she deserves a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Academy Awards. And then I open up on, oh, it's the LA Times.
Well, the LA Film Critics. Yeah, LA Film Critics.
I mean, I'm happy for them. That's perfectly fine. They deserve to honor her. But she's exactly the type of talent. She's a terrific singer. You know, she was a movie star. And she's exactly the sort of person who will not be honored for – she wasn't Oscar nominated. But she's the type of performer who's never going to be nominated for – win an Oscar.
Right.
You know. So she's had this massive career. She was a big, big movie star for two decades. A huge star. And Pillow Talk, by the way, is 1959, not in the 60s. You know, she deserves to be acknowledged in this way by the Academy Awards. They're way long overdue. It's a shame that they haven't done it yet. And I hope this thing by the LA film critics spurs them on.
And your new cable company is YouTube. The website announced an initiative to launch 100 channels with original programming provided by companies like World Wrestling Entertainment, Tony Hawk, Ashton Kutcher, The Wall Street Journal, Fremantle, and many others. They'll offer $150 million in seed money, with channels maxing out at $5 million. That's less than $1 million for most channels, but they will get 55% of ad revenue in most deals. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a very big deal. Just like cable channels realized they had to have original programming to stick out, AMC, FX, you name it. I think now websites are realizing they've got to have original content. That's why Arianna Huffington has 200 people on staff now. That's why YouTube is, you know, churning out $150 million to create something other than cute cats.
YouTube is owned by Google, and as Google, you know, says, $150 million, otherwise known as lunch. $1 a day for a DVD rental? That's been the easy-to-grasp pricing for Redbox, and studios hate it. It's the end of the world and cheapens the value of movies in consumers' minds, say the studios, as they sell movies in bargain bins at your supermarket for $5. So apparently $1 is too low, but $5 is just enough. But if $1 a day is horrible, will the studios be happy if Redbox raises their prices to $1.20? That's Redbox's new price per day starting December 1st for all titles. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. They haven't raised their price in 8 years. They're saying it's because of debit card fees, but you know what? Raising it 20 cents makes perfect sense. After 8 years, it's not exactly a big gouging thing. And the price for Blu-ray remains the same. It's still $1.50. And I think games through Redbox are like $2 per day. It's a modest price increase. I mean, it's 20%, but after 8 years, amortized over all that time, it's pretty fair.
Age is a state of mind. Unless you're an actor, in which case your age can keep you from getting work. SAG and AFTRA are officially objecting to IMDb and the fact that it posts the birth dates of actors and actresses. They say that posting such information can make it harder and harder for actors who hit their 40s to get work because suddenly they're seen as old. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael? And given the fact that IMDb just turned 20 this past week, one would say, congratulations, SAG and AFTRA, and welcome to the 21st century.
I think it's funny that IMDb is 20 years old. It's not a teenager anymore. Now it's soon it'll be 30. Before you know it, you'll be old, you son of a... Sorry. I shouldn't have cursed. Sorry, families. I think it's a big whoop. I mean, SAG and AFTRA, what do you do next? Then you need to go to Wikipedia and tell them to eliminate information from the web. Information gets out. I'm sorry. You know what? People are morons to not use an actor because, oh, she's 40. She's too old. I know it happens, but that won't change for good or ill just because of IMDb.
Hurry, get your Harry Potter DVDs before they disappear forever. Warner Brothers is taking a cue from Disney and announcing that Harry Potter DVDs and Blu-rays will stop shipping on December 29th of this year. So, if you want the latest movie, which is HP 7P2, as we've referred to it, or the Mega Box set, you better buy it now. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
This is a big whoop. Just like Disney, they will be available again in the future.
That's true.
There's no question about that. You know what it is like stores don't have libraries of DVDs anymore anyway. Like 6 months from now, you can't go to Walmart and find, you know, Harry Potter number 3.
That's right.
You know, it's not like Tower Records or the old days where people had a catalog of a library of DVDs. You could just go buy and get Casablanca. So if you want stores to show them, you have to come up with some fake excuse to reissue them. So every couple, that's why there's a brand new release of It's a Wonderful Life with a jokey little bell Christmas tree attached to it, because they have to have an excuse to put out a new copy of the movie. Right. Otherwise, Walmart won't carry it.
And put it on the end cap.
I wonder if they're going to pull Harry Potter from on-demand and streaming, though. That would have been interesting.
Well, okay, now we're really confused, because 2 weeks ago, Netflix signed an 8-year deal with the CW worth some $1 billion, but bizarrely, it didn't include any episodes from current seasons. Now the CW has expanded its deal with Hulu. If you're a subscriber to Hulu, you can watch new episodes the day after they air. If you watch free Hulu, you can watch them 8 days after they air. So tell me again why Netflix paid $1 billion to get old episodes, but no new ones. I mean, I agree. Why? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, it just makes the Netflix deal look worse to me. I thought maybe there was going to be some switch in what was going on. But no, they got Netflix to pay for old stuff and Hulu to pay for new stuff. And CW is happy, but I don't think it makes sense for Netflix.
Well, now, speaking of Netflix, I know we were just talking about bandwidth caps and bandwidth usage. Netflix may have hit a road bump or a pothole or maybe a black hole or a brick wall, but it still gobbles up bandwidth. The online streaming service accounts for 28% of all bandwidth usage on the internet, according to a new study. YouTube is also a big hog, or consumer. It accounts for 35% of all videos streamed, while Netflix only accounts for 5%. So what gives? YouTube users typically watch for 3 minutes at a time, and Netflix users for 42 minutes at a time. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, if they're using this much bandwidth in prime time, again, this raises the issue of internet providers that want to put a cap on your bandwidth usage. It ain't just Netflix, you know. Everybody wants you to put everything in the cloud. Everybody wants you to stream everything. And yet, you know, they're going to try to put a cap on it. And it's a big, big issue. You know, and that raises the question, you know, we were talking about Netflix hitting a bump in the road. Obviously, we're referring to its stock prices.
That's right. They plummeted 35% as the company. Now, they had already said, hey, we're not going to, you know, we're losing some customers. Analysts had said they will lose 1 million customers. Now, you took issue with that, Michael, and you said they're not going to lose 1 million customers.
No. It was that Netflix was lowering the estimate of customers it expected to reach. So it wasn't that they had lost customers, but this actually is a figure about customers who have their subscriber base going down,
right,
as opposed to not reaching a projected future level. This is, in fact, them going from, let's say, 24 million to 23.2 million subscribers. So it is, in this case, about subscribers lost.
Right.
And about their subscriber base going down, which was not the case in the other story that we talked about.
Now, that's 800,000 subscribers that they lost in the third quarter of this year. And they're saying, you know, don't expect some monstrous growth throughout the rest of the year. We probably won't have any growth until 2012.
So they were almost at $300 in July, and they're now at about $77.
Now, that's their stock price, yes. So they have, you know, I mean, their stock price has taken a beating. It's dropped 74%. In a matter of months. I mean,
I would say that, frankly, that they were probably wildly overvalued before.
I think a lot of people felt that.
Right. So I think this is actually a wake-up call to say, to look at the actual numbers and go, well, wait a second. You know, how much do they make a month? They're not even profitable yet. But of course, Amazon's not profitable. Apparently, we're going to have a story in 2050 about Amazon saying, well, we are building market growth and market share. We plan to be profitable in 2052. But anyway.
Speaking of profits and money, the reggae band UB40 may have to file a UB40. That's a document needed for unemployment benefits, and the group is in financial straits. I didn't know that that was a document. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's how they got their name back in the Margaret Thatcher days.
They've been in financial turmoil for 3 years now. Lead singer Ali Campbell left the group after 30 years back in 2008 because of financial management issues, and now the remaining members have been declared bankrupt by a judge and any assets may be seized. Someone hand me the red wine and then tell me, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big whoop. You know, it's just their personal issues, and the band is sort of splintered and gone from what it was for so long. I had no idea, though, that they replaced Ali Campbell with his brother, Duncan Campbell. That's sort of sad. That's very sad.
That is kind of sad.
So that's sadder than this story, frankly.
Well, on a happy note, you know, you have Leonard Cohen, who was bankrupt back in 2005, thanks to being, I guess, bilked out of all of his money due to his business manager took $5 million from him, and he was left with $150,000.
If only I was left with $150,000.
Well, I mean, the guy has sold tons and tons of records over decades, and he's 77 years old, and I saw him perform at Coachella. It was an amazing show. Absolutely nobody performed opposite him. Five stages, only one was operating with Leonard Cohen on it because nobody wanted to go up against him. And also his music is not all that loud, so they didn't want to.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was a great moment in Coachella history. And now he's got another album out, so maybe he'll be back next year for Coachella because he's going to be releasing an album in 2012. It's already recorded.
Right. It's been 8 years since he's had an album of original material. When he was bankrupt, when he was financially bereft, he went back on the road, which he probably didn't want to do. It ended up being a creatively revitalizing thing, was a massive success, far bigger than he anticipated, much bigger tour than he'd ever had in his career. Made a lot of money. God bless him. He deserves it. Banked a lot of money, really woke himself up. And you know, it was a very positive thing. So maybe UB40 will go back out on tour.
Don't be scared on this Halloween day when we record, but Tim Burton has created one of the balloon characters that will be featured in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade this year. You might imagine Burton would be a better fit for the Halloween parade down in the village, but he's come up with B-Boy, a balloon stitched together from all the leftover balloons used at children's birthday parties. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I kind of think it's a big whoop, but certainly in the context of the Thanksgiving Day Parade, because I'm sure everybody with an original prop, you know, with an important franchise like SpongeBob SquarePants and all those things, they kill to get in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. It's a huge visible platform to promote Dora the Explorer and SpongeBob and Snoopy and, you know, all these characters, Spider-Man. Getting an original character that has never existed before into the Thanksgiving Day Parade at this stage, I think, is pretty big news. And it's pretty cool that it's Tim Burton. I'd be interested to see what it looks like.
Adele will undergo surgery on her vocal cords. 6 final shows in the UK have already been canceled, and she'll be resting her voice completely for the rest of the year. Let's hope she's not using the same surgeon as Julie Andrews. Ooh, low blow. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. She's a huge star, and she's getting vocal surgery. God bless her. You know, she might want to try quit smoking.
That might
not
help.
Be such a bad idea either.
Yeah. Ticketmaster is paying up. The company has settled a class action lawsuit for redirecting fans trying to buy tickets to Bruce Springsteen, Miley Cyrus, and others. They were sent to a more expensive resale site, even though in some cases, Ticketmaster still had tickets for sale to those shows.
Boo.
Yeah.
Boo.
And in fact, guess who owned that resale site? Ticketmaster. The company is setting aside some $16 million for the settlement, which includes $2.5 million for the lawyers, $5,000 for the 3 lead plaintiffs, and an offer of $10 in cash or up to $18 off on your next purchase at Tickets Now, which is the secondary.
The secondary, highly priced, yes. Overpriced secondary ticket market.
Right.
Yes.
So you get $18 off your $1,000 ticket. There's no word on what service fee the court may charge Ticketmaster for each payment. We'd suggest, another $10. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I don't know if it is a big deal. I'd like to know how much they've been making off Tickets Now and these other companies. My problem with these penalties is that they're often not big enough, you know.
And they have to be claimed by the people who, you know, it's
right.
Yeah, it's kind of a
right,
joke.
And it's a complicated pain in the neck procedure. And like, you're a Wall Street firm and you rip off people for $800 million and you pay a record $20 million fine, but you keep the $780 million profits. So I wish this were enough to really shame Ticketmaster and cause them problems. Or I would wish it would force them to, you know, you know, not be able to do it, or to somehow say, hey, you know, this is a different company. If you want to, you know, I mean, it should be against the law for them to try and push you to buy overly priced tickets when you're going there to buy tickets that they have available.
Well,
you know,
yeah, there's a lot of things that Ticketmaster does that should be against the law, but aren't.
Right. It's very shameful, but I wish it was higher, and I wish they actually had to pay more of a penalty no matter what.
The toxicology report on the late singer Amy Winehouse is out, and it's sad news. She literally drank herself to death. Her blood alcohol content was 5 times the legal driving limit in the United Kingdom, and well above the level associated with fatalities. 3 empty vodka bottles were found in her hotel room. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. Nobody is surprised. The family was trying to, sadly, convince themselves somehow that this was not related to all her addiction problems. You know, like, well, she wasn't on drugs. Well, no, she just, you know, drank 3 bottles of vodka or whatever. You know, I mean, this
right.
is a very sad story. It's good to know what the facts are. And that, you know, it's sad, but it's true. I mean, she drank herself to death. It's a very sad thing. I always feel a little conflicted with Charlie Sheen being mentioned, that like we're not holding him to the same standard. But, you know, people's personal lives are their personal lives. When they're on stage stumbling down drunk and can't perform, you know, you got to wake up to the facts. Nothing could have stopped her from hurting herself. It's a shame that it happened. But I don't blame people for what she did to herself, but it was so sad to see this train wreck happening and not be able to do anything about it.
That's true. Hilary Swank has fired her manager of 8 years. Why? Because he didn't stop her from going to Chechnya to toast the birthday of a cruel ruler widely condemned for his vicious human rights violations, even though Amnesty International contacted her people directly before the event to warn her about his record. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, firing her manager, you know, she's like, just making a big statement about this. I mean, Jean-Claude Van Damme, other people are implicated. This happens all the time. I hope everybody in Hollywood and the entertainment industry gets shamed to death over this crap.
Well, remember when Beyonce kind of did this New Year's Eve concert for Gaddafi's son?
Yeah, they all do. Beyonce, Mariah Carey. I'm like, why are you doing this? Like, first of all, who needs to be told you shouldn't take 6 figures to go party at a dictator's house in Chechnya? He's a dictator, you know, and at the party, she boasted on video about how much she knew about Chechnya, really did her homework before coming there. Why would any celebrity risk their image by doing any of this crap? I don't get it. Man or woman, is it really worth it to pay the bar mitzvah for the kid of some billionaire who's going to turn out to be a scam artist on Wall Street? Or, you know, jet off to hang in Abu Dhabi, like Wynton Marsalis and a lot of other people do, which is a country that basically has slave labor. I mean, don't go for the easy 6 figures, you know, like protect your image, show a little decency, avoid dictators and countries with cruel human rights records.
Well, you know, I think that a large reason this happens is because These folks think that they
make tons of money.
Well, and they think they can get away with it, that nobody will ever find out that I played the birthday party of, you know, Gaddafi's son. You know, and in the end, they are right. Sometimes it's never discovered, and sometimes, like with Hilary Swank and Beyonce, and as you just mentioned, Wynton Marsalis, it is discovered. And it's a very easy way, very quick and very lucrative way to make a lot of money and be able to continue your career without
to continue your lifestyle.
Yes, correct.
But with the cameras, with every phone having video on it now, it would seem impossible to me. Do they like have some sort of blanket thing when they party at like...
No, and I think you're right. It's going to get harder and harder for all of these folks, and you know, these actors and musicians to do these kinds of events without it appearing on YouTube moments later. You're absolutely
that?
Right.
What was the financial firm that collapsed? My mind is totally
Lehman
blank.
Brothers?
No. Earlier than that. And, you know, they started showing the lavish parties that the owner would have.
Oh, AIG.
Yeah, that's not. Is it AIG? Yeah. And you just think, you know what? You think, oh, I'm just going to go party for, AIG. What's the big deal? It's like, I don't know. It's kind of whorish anyway. And I don't mean to use – I shouldn't use whorish because it was mostly women we were talking about there. But it's just sad. It just seems like it's not worth your public image.
Well, be that as it may, that ends Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week's story is kind of getting a lot of press because a bipartisan group of House members has kind of drafted this bill, this legislation, and they introduced it on Wednesday, and it's all about piracy and copyright protection. Effectively, what this bill would allow the government's authority to disrupt and shutter websites that hawk or host trademark and or copyrighted infringing products, including allowing the government to actually take over the site and to get Amex and Visa and Google to stop supporting them financially. So if you have Google ads, they can go in and make Google shut down the ad account. And so you
okay, so we have these pirate websites all over the world that download that offer free downloads of movies and TV shows
That's
and music
right.
or whatever.
Yes.
Previously, what happened was that companies would go to the internet service providers and say, hey, you shouldn't host them. You shouldn't let them be accessible. Or they'd go to Google and say, hey, don't let them be shown up on search results when people are looking for pirate material.
That's right. And Google said, look, it's a free internet. And the ISP said the same thing. We are not the police. Don't come to us. Go after the sites themselves. Don't come after us.
And the biggest problem we've had is that there's been no – when people have acted or done something, there's been no legal process. This legislation at least does offer some sort of oversight. What happens when somebody says – a company goes to the Justice Department and says, hey, this pirate website is downloading Tintin? What happens?
They obtain a court order demanding that all of these ISPs only in America because, of course –
they have no jurisdiction overseas.
Outside, right. So they are going to stop rendering the DNS, domain name system, so you won't be able, you know, when you type in Amazon.com, that's actually a number on a web server somewhere, and the domain name system takes care of that. So now Amazon.com, for instance, wouldn't resolve to that number. So effectively, it would bring down the wall on those websites. However,
if a website was blocked, it wouldn't appear when you typed in the name.
You
couldn't get to it.
However, and this is part of the issue here, and this kind of goes to show you how sticky this legislation is, that this newest proposal actually says that you can get in trouble for explaining to people like our listeners or writing about it. If you're a journalist and writing about, well, you can't, you know, type in weripped off your movie.com, but you can type in the IP address of a site to get there. Well, now, if this law were enacted, I would be liable for sending people off, telling people the workaround.
If you gave people a way that they could go around the blocking?
Right, correct. Which is a very easy way if you're technically proficient.
They can't block the number?
They cannot block the number, no.
Why is that?
Because it's a direct call. You're basically calling person to, you know, machine to machine as opposed to... And I'm sure there are ways to block the IP address, but that's a totally different...
Is some judicial oversight. Before... companies were just, you know, being told you should just act and do it because we tell you they're a bad company. Now at least the Justice Department must go to a judge and make a case, not legally go through a whole trial, but simply convince a federal judge that they have reasonable belief that this website is dealing in trafficking pirated material.
Right. And all of these things are, you know, all of this legislation, all of these laws are, you know, it's the
legislation. It's not passed yet. It's proposed laws.
Yes, correct. Yeah, these bills. They're all, you know, hawked by, you know, the MPAA or the, you know, the recording industry. It's big entertainment companies that want to see this happen. This is like the golden goose. This is the brass ring. If they can get some kind of law passed by Congress that forces ISPs to start blocking these sites, that's huge.
It's good that there's some judicial oversight. I assume there would presumably be a way for a company to complain. They're probably not going to be coming up with, you know, me and my college dorm room. They're going to be dealing with the big pirate websites. But
that's right.
There's always
absolutely
a concern that they expand into personal territories.
Right. But in a year in which we saw the Arab Spring, the counterpoint to this is, or the opposition to this is, you know, the whole thing with the internet is it's a democratizer. You know, it really, if that's even a word, it allows, it's free, it's open, it allows for free speech, even in areas where there is no free speech. And if you start closing things down, much the way China does,
don't compare a government trying to stifle its own people from speaking to each other to, you know, blocking a company that's a pirate company that's just trying to give you free downloads of Avatar.
Well, the fear is that the way the legislation is written, it leaves it open for debate. And that's what most people have an issue with here.
Well, that's more about the stuff where they try and keep you from being able to mention a workaround.
And other issues, yeah. I mean, it's a very long piece of legislation, so we're not going to get into all of it here. Right. But
well, that obviously needs to be refined or worked on. But is there any problem that you see with the general thing of the Justice Department goes to a judge, shows him that this is a pirated website, and we want to make it harder for people to access it? Is there anything wrong with that? Does that seem reasonable? Does that seem like a good step to you?
You know, it does seem like if it's just that, then maybe. I mean, I would imagine that there has to be some way that the website itself could then turn around and say, actually, you know, to defend themselves.
Right. But absolutely, I'm not downplaying that. But there's not a lot of there's plenty of pirated companies that are clearly illegal
to deal
with. It's not like they're trying to come up with cases, you know, out of the blue. They're not looking. It's not hard to find a lot of companies doing this.
Yes, and I don't think this will actually stem piracy at all, because it will only work within the United States. Most of these companies these websites are based outside the United States. They would still be accessible from outside the United States.
But it's talking about people in the U.S. accessing them.
Yes, correct.
Well, and that certainly happens a lot in the U.S.
Yes, but I'm just saying it's not a silver bullet.
Well, but it's a good if they make it harder and there's a judicial oversight and it's a reasonable step and they eliminate or you know, greatly reduce the workaround provisions in it. What's the objection?
You know, we should actually do a special show on this or a special segment on this, because there are a lot, and we have in the past, but now there's yet another piece of legislation coming up, because there are lots of people who believe that. It, you know, we would all have different internets. Italy would have a different internet than the U.S. The U.K. would have a different internet than the U.S. And that's what they fear would start to happen, is that if it happens here, it's going to start happening everywhere, including in places where they will be doing it not to censor piracy, but to censor.
Well, but this is an entirely different issue.
Right. Precisely. So we should probably wrap up, you know, Inside Baseball for this week. We do have one email.
Great.
Do you want to read it, or do you want me to read it?
I'll be happy to.
It's from Asad Boot. He is an MBA, MS, and Media Ventures candidate for 2012, and he is attending the Boston University School of Management.
He's a grad student?
I believe so.
All right, good for him. I hope he's not saddled with too much debt. It says, "Hey guys, great episode last week, as always." Oh, thank you. "I wanted to comment on the Tower Heist $60 premium pay-per-view conversation you had last week. While I agree with you that it is an outrageous amount of money to pay for that film, I think you neglected to consider various audiences who might be willing to pay that much. Two come to mind. The first is the growing number of people who have built really nice movie theater-like experiences in their homes and are looking for an excuse to showcase their cool digs to their friends and families. The second is the legion of parents out there with small kids who would probably spend $50 or more on a babysitter in addition to $20 on tickets and potentially dinner. For them, $60 is a steal. I think action movies... Is that Tower Heist an action movie or a comedy? Well, it's an action comedy, Asad. I think action movies could sell well to the first group, not so much with the second group. But I think there's definitely a solid chance to profitably market this premium pay-per-view to the second group come award season, when you have a lot of movies generating a lot of buzz. This group and others would pay a premium to see content in their homes just so they can be a part of the discussion. Anyways, just my two cents. Mind you, I neither have a home theater or small kids, so what do I know, really? Love the show and look forward to future episodes. Best, Asad Boot.
Yeah, and I think that he's right. I mean, there are times I cannot see an award-nominated film. I still haven't seen Black Swan in its entirety because of that. Because I have kids, and I can't, you know, my time is limited. I can't go out and see every film, and if I don't catch a trade screening or a press screening, then, you know, sometimes I won't see a film, and that's kind of a shame. And I wouldn't pay $60. I might not pay, I'm not going to pay $50. But if it was available for $10 on a pay-per-view, I might do it.
Absolutely right. Those are two audiences that will pay for pay-per-view. They do now. The big question here is the window of opening it so soon after it opened.
That's really
whether
the issue.
That's early or right or not. But he's right. These are the people that studios have in mind when they make pay-per-view available. And the high price early on in the run could be enough for people who want to stay in the conversation. Somebody's going to experiment with this at some point, and we'll see how it goes.
Oh, I learned a lot about this last week and about how this whole thing came about with Universal and what was going on. And effectively, Regal was going to say, we're not playing the film either, which is why Universal reversed itself. And it was quite interesting. But
Yeah, Universal's having a bad year. They really want a big hit. So I don't think they realized, you know, we don't want to play around with one of our last big movies of the year.
Right, precisely. But that wraps up Inside Baseball for this week. And, you know, even though we tried to put less stories in the show notes, we still wound up going long. So sorry about that. Now, you can subscribe to Showbiz Sandbox in a number of places, including iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher.com, which is a way to listen to podcasts on the go. We're actually part of the BlackBerry Podcast Network, for those of you who still have BlackBerries, like myself. You can follow us on Twitter. Our username is Showbiz Sandbox. You can friend us over on Facebook. Again, our username is Showbiz Sandbox over there. You can also find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's show at our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you will find ways to contact us, much like Asad just did. He emailed dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. And if I'm not mistaken, it's next week or in 2 weeks, MGMT will be giving two performances at the Guggenheim Museum on November 10th and 11th. So check them out if you're in New York. Michael can also be checked out in New York, but probably a little easier is going to michaelgiltz.com.
I wish someone would check me out.
Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.